Hey, everyone. I am Angela Frazier, and I'm the Vice President of Student Services at Waukesha County Technical College. It's a two-year school located in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, and welcome to the Alp.
Nailed it.
Nailed it.
Welcome to the ALP, the Admissions Leadership Podcast, a series of one-on-one conversations with people who have been climbing the leadership mountain in college admissions. Some are nearing the summit, some are already there. But how did they get there, and what can other climbers learn from their mindsets, habits, and experiences? I'm your host, Ken Anselman, VP for Enrollment Management at RHB. And with me today, as you heard from my home state of Wisconsin, Woo-hoo! Angela Frazier. Hey, welcome to the ALP, Angela.
Hey, Ken. I'm so excited. Thank you for having me. I mean, sincerely.
This is fun. So, and can you believe, and this is the part where it's just people are going to get to overhear us having a conversation, but it was just a little more than a year ago that we first met each other.
Yes.
In Chicago, NACAC's Elevate Equity Conference.
Which was one of my top favorite conferences that I've ever gone to in my career.
Really?
And I've been doing this for... My son's 29, so 28 years.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. We met in passing. I think we were standing near the hot dogs or something. it was Super Bowl Sunday, right?
We're
in the ballroom at the Sheraton in Chicago on the Riverwalk, and they really did a nice job realizing, oh no, we scheduled this during the Super Bowl and had like Chicago food theme. But you and I clicked, and I don't know. Is it the Wisconsin thing? Is it the fact that you and I share the same names as my parents? which probably not as exciting for you as it was for me.
I don't know what it was. And you and I started talking just like a 15-minute conversation. Then it was like a 30-minute conversation. And then it was like, I think we're going to be friends from this point forward. And I think we even looked at each other and was just like, I think we're going to be friends.
Yeah. What just happened?
Yeah. Yes.
And here we are.
Here we are.
I think last time we spoke in real life, we were in Pewaukee,
not far from
campus.
That's correct.
We were on the other side of a big moment that was coming up in your family.
Right?
and I prepped you that you would actually be speaking about this. So you mentioned the 29-year-old son.
Yes.
And you were in pre-wedding mode.
It's crazy wedding mold. That's what it was.
You were not crazy.
You
were calmer than the Angela in my life before my wedding. So
I was that, you know, I didn't want to be a, you know, it's my only male child. He's the first, you know, I have a bonus daughter who's also an Angela. How great is that? And
well
so
done.
My son decided that he wanted to have this extravagant wedding. And people kept asking this question. Tia, his wife, I didn't know Tia was so expensive. I said, it's not Tia. It's your nephew. He's the one that's expensive. You know, I was like, do you remember when he was in high school and we went shopping for prom and we were looking for shoes and he picked up some Ferragamo shoes. I think that's how you pronounce it. And they were like $800. And I was like, we're not buying those. But that's how the wedding was.
This is raw and real. Here we go.
It was like, and my son is one of my favorite humans that exist in this world. And we fought often because I kept saying your wedding is more expensive than some people's salaries. And that was really bothering me. It was outstanding. And it was 175 people that all traveled to Houston Labor Day weekend. So Houston, Labor Day weekend, the heat was a killer that weekend.
Oh my gosh,
and my son said it was it was a vibe, Mom. It was a vibe. It was an amazing event. And I'm so proud of him because he made it happen. He doesn't owe any debt from it. And that probably is because he lived with his mother for like 2.5 years and could save up all of his money. But it was worth it. It was definitely worth it. So thank you for asking and remembering. I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you for letting us in on that. And congratulations, Mom.
Thank you.
Well done. Well done. We You mentioned in your introduction, and thank you for pointing out, it's a 2-year college. And
yes.
Before we started recording, I think I pointed out to you, I don't think I've actually had a sitting VP, I'm a leader from a 2-year school. And so you get to speak on behalf of all 2-year colleges everywhere, Angela, with every question that I'm about to ask. I am totally kidding. But
you know, I appreciate that you are stating that, because I lived most of my career in the 4-year private. And transitioning to a 2-year, I'd go to conferences and I'd say, gosh, their work seems so hard because your students are transient. You don't know, like, if they're coming back from term to term. So your retention numbers are really wonky. It's hard to recruit because you're like, hey, come to me because we're cheaper. But then you have the 4-year that's given this massive discount. And so you're like competing with that. But there's not a lot of research on 2-year schools. I'm seeing more and more. But even when you buy technology solutions, they're all geared towards the 4-year schools.
Okay.
So
okay.
There's a market for us.
Yeah, let's start there. Let's start in a bunch of different places and see where we go. But I am curious. So you mentioned your experience was 4-year schools.
Yes.
And here you are coming to Waukesha County Technical College. How'd you get there? And then, and maybe before we get there, let me ask, what's in your portfolio?
Oh, it's a pretty large portfolio.
It's massive,
so
right?
It is.
I mean, it's a small leadership team at WCTC.
So, you know, we have 18,000 students here at WCTC, and it's a wide breadth of students because it is high school students, it is corporate training, it is traditional age, it's adults returning, it's apprenticeships. So it is a lot. And my portfolio, I try to divide it into 3 different areas. Enrollment services is one of the areas, and our enrollment team is really kicking butt. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But enrollment services, and then I have a student support services area, and that's all of your outside of the classroom, you know, academic advising, career. And then I have registration and records, and ensuring that we are following all FERPA guidelines, but students can register and they can schedule their classes and get some transcripts. But our enrollment team, you know, when I started here, here's what was interesting. When I interviewed, they were like, we need to increase enrollment by 3%. And I kept asking this question, 3% of what? And nobody could give me that answer. And we need our retention to be at 3%, increase by 3%, and our completion to increase by 3%. And I just was looking for the hard line numbers. Okay. And so I was asking those questions. So what are you doing to increase it by 3%? No one could answer that question. I had an admissions team, and then I had this other team that was called outreach, but they reported to marketing. Mm-hmm. And then admissions reported it was a direct report up to me as the vice president, but they didn't talk to each other. So outreach was going out doing career fairs and high school, college fairs and, you know, generating applications. But then they would have to send a student to go and meet with an admission person to complete the application. And I said, huh?
And that sounds like a barrier.
Oh my gosh. And I had a VP of enrollment services that I worked with years ago, enrollment management. Pam Johnson was her name. Shout out to Pam Johnson in case you're listening to this. And I'll never forget something that she said to me. She said, you never make a student come back to campus more than once. Let them take care of everything in one sitting, setting, whatever it is, you know, even if it's online. And I kept thinking to myself, you're not increasing your enrollment by 3% because you're putting students through a ringer and they don't know where to get on, where to get off, who should talk. I mean, I had my academic advisors meeting with prospective students, career specialists. I said, so who helps the student actually get enrolled? So when I arrived here almost 4 years ago, there was a lot of things that needed to be changed. And as my boss, the president, often says, fix the machine, Angela, fix the machine. So I've been spending time fixing the machine. And if many of us would take that approach, because I don't want students having to go through hoops and loops just to get enrolled,
Oh, Angela. Okay. So let's go here. So you've been fixing the machine. There are a lot of folks, 2-year colleges, 4-year colleges, who have the same challenge, right?
I know.
So what have you fixed? And how have you fixed it?
So I'll start
this
with,
sounds like a job interview question.
But
I'd be curious what experiences have you had there that might other folks might think, oh, I could do this at my place too.
Well, the first thing, we created this cross-functional enrollment team that was meeting once a week, and it was academic affairs as well as student services or enrollment services team to say, what are the issues that you are seeing from an enrollment lens? You know, and I think we had a list. It was like 180 plus things on that list. And it was anything from, you know, the application fee, or it was like, how do I find the application online? Or it was open house may not, we haven't had an open house because of COVID, you know, that nasty thing, that pandemic, sure. You know.
Yeah, that's right. Cause you started.
I started during the pandemic. And not only did I start in the pandemic, I was living in Accra, Ghana, West Africa at the time. So,
okay.
Go figure that. And I'm
working
remotely. And I'm trying to
really
fix the machine.
Remotely?
And it was also too, I had too many hands in the pot that a student didn't know who was their source of contact. You know, who should be my person? So the very first thing that I changed, and I know people are going to be so angry at me, especially at the 2-year college, I stopped having academic advisors and career specialists meet with prospective students, because I had these outreach specialists, as they were called, who had 10, 15 years of enrollment experience, and no one was trusting them on their own experience. You know, they had been recruiting students. They had been going to college fairs. One of them is completing her doctorate at Johns Hopkins. And so she had all these great ideas, and it was hard to get the administration to buy her new ideas. Mm. So, you know, it became a one-stop shop for enrollment. And I know that doesn't make sense, but it had to be a one-stop.
Oh, it does make sense.
Yeah, I was just like,
it does make sense.
I just need them to have one point of contact.
Well, and freeing up your advising resources to work with your continuing students instead of your front-end students.
Exactly.
Because if you want to increase your retention, you got to devote some resources on that side too.
And that was the other piece too. We devoted some resources. So I created a Dean of Enrollment Services who absolutely knows everyone within the system. I swear this, you can't go anywhere with my dean and he doesn't know a person from the enrollment world. And that's because he was a roadrunner. And that made
and
all
who
the,
would this be?
John McGrill.
Of course. That was a setup, Angela.
Yeah, I know. I know.
He'll be so happy to hear his name on the ALP.
He literally has brought in all of his ideas that he did as a roadrunner, as a director of admissions, and, you know, coupled with some research to say, why don't we change a couple of things? And I mean, just little tweaks. For example, we have a foundation that raises money and they have these named scholarships and so forth, but they were not being distributed. So he said, why don't I leverage those to prospective students to get them to come to WCTC? And that made a world of difference. So if I'm doing applied technologies, anything from welding or automotive, like we have scholarships for that. That increased their numbers. He also gave something as simple as, and you're going to be like, what? You're going to be like, huh, something that's because the 2-year schools were not adopting what the 4-year schools were doing. So you get admitted. So what he decided to do was have the president go and deliver your welcome to WCTC. You've been admitted and then give them a yard sign. We were not giving out yard signs. We were not giving out stickers to say, hey, I go to WCTC, or when you came to
campus.
Embrace
the pride.
Yes. Yeah. When you came to campus for a tour, they were not getting a t-shirt, no swag at all. So we increased his
budget.
So
putting some 4-year practices into a 2-year. Yeah, yeah.
And not everything is going to work that you did at the 4-year, but you can adopt and try things out. I have this philosophy that I've been teaching, and thank God my president has the same philosophy. Let's try it. And if it works, that's fine. If it doesn't, what did you learn from it? And just, you know, make some augmentations and try it again. Try it in a different way. And that really made a difference, because students now had a pride about like, oh, I'm just going to a 2-year school. No, I'm going to WCTC, you know, and it's going to make a difference in my career path that I want to take. So it was just making those little changes. And Ken, if I can brag a little bit,
please.
So
that's why we're here.
John started January of 2022. By fall, and we had been for 10 years, our enrollment had declined by 30%. Okay.
Yeah.
And by fall of 2022, we had saw a 1% increase. By spring, it gone up to 4%. By last fall, it was 8%. No one's talking about an 8% increase during a demographic cliff. And it was making simple, practical changes that made the big difference. And then,
and a demographic cliff and a pretty good competition from just high wages, right?
My goodness. And we're saturated because we just did a research study and our students, they're not going to four-year schools. They're not going to other two-year schools. They're going to the workforce.
They're going to work, right?
They're going to work. They are going
to
work.
And you're still claiming a big chunk of the market share.
A big chunk of the market.
That's awesome.
And even our retention, we made some changes with our retention, like taking the advisors away from prospective students, allowed them to really focus on current students. We also implemented degree works because our students could not be partners on their academic journey. Now they can see what do they have remaining. You know, I don't always have to talk to a person. I know exactly what I need to do. And our retention has increased by 3%.
Oh, nice.
So I finally got that 3% increase.
Okay. And you found out what the number was that you were supposed to raise from, what the baseline was?
Yes.
Just to do the callback.
Yes.
Angela, you, for folks who may not be familiar, you mentioned DegreeWorks, and not like they're advertising on here, but it's a helpful tool, especially if folks are thinking about going to, for staying on track for graduating, completing your program, but B, if you're thinking about going on to get a bachelor's degree beyond that, it can also help with the academic planning and transferology and things like that. Could you say a little bit more about DegreeWorks? And
let me tell you,
that's been for you all?
DegreeWorks has been life-changing for our institution. I've always wanted DegreeWorks. I read about them probably 10 years ago, and I wanted DegreeWorks, but I worked at a private tuition-dependent institution, and so they didn't have the funding for DegreeWorks. And then I got here, and my advisors were saying, we don't have a decent auditing tool. It takes us 8 screens to figure out what a student still has remaining. I was like, what? Like 8? Like, that's not efficient, you know? And so we began to investigate what's a tool that we can use that will support not only the academic advisors, but more importantly, the students. At the heart of everything that I do is about the student experience. Whether you're a prospective student, I need to ensure that it's easy and seamless, you know, to get enrolled, to have a conversation with an enrollment counselor, to go through our new student orientation. To our current students, they need to be able to actually look at what are the requirements that they need. When we implemented DegreeWorks, and this is what I mean by two-year schools don't get the support that they need. Really, we were working off DegreeWorks from a four-year model, and they had to augment it for a two-year school. Because even in their demonstrations, it's like, oh, if your major is this. Well, most two-year schools call everything programs. That was an adjustment for me. And your programs are designed based on, you know, what the state requires, what your district kind of defines what your workforce looks like. And so you have these advisory committees, and then you have the faculty who are building this. And it was eye-opening to see the challenges that our students were experiencing, because the courses that were posted online weren't always offered. And so the implementation woke up the entire college to say, we need to fix some things so that we can simplify things for our students. And it has made a tremendous change. And then it also means too, that if I can't get a hold of my advisor, but I have this favorite faculty member that I always meet with, you know, I love their class. They can just pull up their degree audit and say, I see that you need Y, and Z, you know,
so centralized. So
exactly.
So students can feel seen.
Seen and right? important. That is what's important. Because if we're taking your money, we want to ensure that you have a return on investment.
Yeah. Oh, Angela. So it sounds like WCTC did a nice thing bringing in a stranger from the outside to help them find some things that were hiding in plain sight. You mentioned a couple of things that may have, you know, program instead of major or major instead.
That was different for me.
What was it like making that transition from a four-year institution, and you know, your entire career was that, to a two-year institution? And, you know, what sort of things, what sort of assumptions did you have maybe that were tested or overturned? Let's be vulnerable a little bit, but it's also a way of saying, you know, what do people get wrong about two-year institutions?
That's a really good question. So I'll tell you, I worked in Illinois for a number of years, so in the Chicago area, and I always wanted to work at a two-year school. And so here's the assumption why I wanted to work at a two-year school, because I was at a private Catholic institution that had no money, and the two-year schools, their salary was 10 to 15% higher than what I was making. So I was just like, okay, that's one thing. The other assumption the other assumption that I had was that, you know, it's an extension of high school. And so there's no depth to their programs or course offerings.
Yeah.
And then one day I had an aha moment, and it was in a faculty meeting, and somebody was talking about the transfer process, and they were saying, well, I don't know if there was strength in that class, or if, you know, what was the rigor in that class. And I said, put it like this. So you went to University of Illinois Champaign, and, you know, your friend Ken also went to U of I Champaign, but Ken decided to work at a two-year school and Angela decided to work at a four-year school. We all got the same pedagogical teaching, you know, in that classroom. We just chose to work in different lenses of higher ed. And they're like, so there's going to be rigor. And so the thing about two-year schools, they think that there's no rigor. And there is rigor. You know, students are experiencing the same stresses. So I was just like, they just go in and out. It's commuter. They don't want to be involved. Wrong. I mean, my SGA here is so involved. I mean,
SGA.
Student Government Association. Yep. Sorry, I hate acronyms.
No. That's why I'm here.
Like on Friday, I went to a fashion show that was hosted by our cosmetology students and our Student Government Association. And it was a diverse fashion show. And they were wearing their own clothes, but they had the cosmetology students and esthetician students do their makeup and hair. And I was just like, that's a really great idea. So you would think that the two-year school, that there's no student activities that are happening, but they are happening.
Or interdisciplinarity or anything like that.
Yes, exactly.
That's great.
But can I tell you the one thing that really shocked me more than anything else? And so for those that are listening to this podcast, was the salaries that our students make leaving the two-year school. That threw me for a complete loop. So the average salary for our students that graduate from WCTC is about between $50,000 and $55,000. Now, I now have a doctorate, but when I graduated from college and even with my master's, I want to say my starting salary was like $38,000. And I'm like, these students are coming out making some real money. And if you're in one of our apprenticeship programs where your company, we have lots of industry in our area, like General Electric Health, Electric, you know, has an entire manufacturing plant.
Yeah, they're just right down. They're just down the street.
Generac, who does, generators. You know, if you get an apprenticeship with one of them, $107,000 is your average starting salary.
Okay. And so, are you on the recruiting team? Because,
But it's that those are narratives that my recruiters can go out and say, when you leave here, here's what your starting salary is going to be. Here's your average starting salary. And 94% of our students say that they are thankful and grateful of the education because it's practical, that they can apply right when they start the workforce. I mean, I had lunch yesterday with one of my mentees, and she's at $56,000 with a 2-year degree, and she just graduated last May. And so, again, it is also the economy. I have to factor that in. And I graduated, I won't say how long ago, but you know, that people need to know that those are the starting salaries with people who have 2-year degrees.
Yeah. Well, and you started by saying it's an extension of, some people think it's an extension of high school, but there's sort of like it's a less than. Or even when you were describing, you know, two people coming out of the same undergrad institution and working at two different places, but there's sort of a pecking order.
It is a pecking order.
Or a hierarchy or a or classism or whatever you want to call it.
And you know what really bothers me is, you know, we all want to be the Harvards, but Harvard had a Harvard had like a 400 year start. And so, you know, be the best of who you're going to be. I know one of your questions that I had been mulling over in my head, like, what if he asked me, like, who should we be? And I'm like, I tell my president all the time, I try to be the best of Angela. I don't try to be somebody else. I tell my department and my teams, be the best that you're going to be. Stop comparing yourself to other institutions and to your schools. That's what they do. But you can take some of those best practices and say, how can I adapt them to my institution and my department, you know, make it granular to my staff, you know, to my programming, you know, and stop trying to chase after these other four-year big schools because you're not going to be them. We don't have their endowments. You know, we don't have a 400-year start. We, you know, we've been around for 100 years at Waukesha County Technical College, and we should be proud of that 100 years. We celebrated our 100th anniversary last year. And I think that's amazing that for 100 years in our community, we've been transforming the lives of not only students, but also our workforce partners, because now they have skilled workers that can ensure that our world keeps moving. And we discovered during the pandemic, like if we didn't have truck driving, what were we going to do? How are we going to get our supplies? But we have a CDL program and we have a nursing program, and our nursing students score in the 96th or 97th percentile on not the PACS, but what is the NCLEX? I couldn't think of what it was called. And don't make me tell you what NCLEX stands for.
I'm not going to.
But everybody in nursing knows what
listeners can go look it up if they're curious.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're producing top students to go into the workforce.
Yeah.
And I think that's a misnomer about two-year schools. They just think that no one talked to me about going to a two-year technical college when I was in high school. And it could have been, I was in all college prep courses, but you could have had that conversation with me because, you know, I'm low income. Yeah. I was poor. I tell people I was P-O. We couldn't afford the O-R. You know, first generation. I know, Ken, you get the live in color, Angela. You know,
and Angela, for just the trajectory, where did you start? Where was home?
My home is Southeast Wisconsin. I'm from Racine, and I vowed that I was never coming back to Wisconsin because first generation African American, low income, and I dealt with, and I didn't know this term when I was growing up, but I was microaggressed my entire life, and I didn't even realize that. And it was, oh, well, you're smart. How come other Black kids are not smart? And I'm like, they are. Oh, you have your mom and dad still live together. I'm like, don't your parents still live together? Because I thought all parents lived together, you know, and I said I was never coming back. And I went to school in Alabama, and people will be like, oh my gosh, so you left Southeast Wisconsin thinking it was going to be better in Alabama?
Yeah. Well, and you went to Talladega.
I went to Talladega. I went to the oldest historically Black college in Alabama. And that was a culture shock for me because, you know, in high school and grade school, I was the smartest Black girl. And then I get to Talladega and everybody was smart. And I was like, oh, there's a lot of smart Black people. But it also grounded me, and it let me know that I can't put my perceptions on other people. That's not fair to them, you know, and it grounded me with a level of confidence as well, because I also don't care what other people think about me, because that's what I was taught in college, because that's your business, how you feel about me, you know. And it also reminded me, I was just reading something the other day about Talladega, you know, when I went to college, the number was much higher, but now it says 80% of their graduates go on to get an advanced degree. And when I started, they said that we were number one for a college our size and the number of people that went on to get a doctorate degree. Now, I'm a first generation college student. I don't know what a doctorate is. Like, what is that? I know what a medical doctor is, but I don't know anything else. What's a PhD? And I knew that I wanted to get a PhD right from my freshman year, because I was like, I want to be in that number that Talladega is reporting. So it just it opened up my eyes to possibilities. That's such a good word now that I'm thinking about it. Possibilities and opportunities, because I don't think I would have been able to know that these opportunities existed for people of color when you come from Southeast Wisconsin.
Huh.
And here I'm in the wealthiest county.
Yeah.
And the whitest county in the state. And I'm the first African-American. As a matter of fact, I'm the first African-American vice president at Waukesha County Technical College.
Really?
I was the first.
I
was the first one at Dominican University as well.
Okay. How does a kid from Southeast Wisconsin, from Racine, home of the Kringle.
Yes.
Look it up, people. find her way to, and I'm sorry, I mispronounced it. Find her way to Talladega. How did you, of all the colleges that were out there, choose Alabama?
You're going to crack up.
Choose Talladega.
You've met me before.
And I don't know the answer to this one, so I'm curious to see where this goes.
You're going to be like, she is something else. For those who cannot see me, that's why. You're going to be like, okay, this makes sense. So I had a high school counselor, Gene Matthews was his name. I went to William Horlick High School in Racine. Mm-hmm. And he was from Dothan, Alabama. And he said to me, the smartest women I knew and the prettiest women I knew all graduated from Talladega College. And I said, oh, I'm smart and I'm pretty, so I'm going there. That's a vain response.
It's a great response. Are you kidding me?
It is exactly what he said to me. And that is the reason. And I went there sight unseen because my mother had a stroke my senior year in high school. And my father had already been in a wheelchair since I was six. And so I didn't have anyone to take me on a college tour. And college tours are so important. And let me just, I'm a pause on that. That's another piece that we did here. We made it intentional about bringing students to WCTC, because if they can see the campus, we know that works at the 4-year, they fall in love, and that helped increase our applicants and our enrollment. So back to Talladega, I went sight unseen, showed up just for freshman orientation and just fell in love. Thank God I did. And my roommate was a fourth generation Talladega College student. Her parents, her grandparents, her great grandparents all graduated from Talladega College.
Wow.
So, and I didn't know that because I know that Black people were going to college because we were not when I graduated from high school.
And then you found your way back or the Midwest called you back.
It did. So I've bounced all over the Midwest. I lived in Ohio because I went to graduate school. I went to the Ohio State University, and I always make sure I say the Ohio State University.
Yeah.
So
it's not confused with just a.
I know.
Or an Ohio State University. Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
And then I went there because I was in love with a man, and out of this love produced this wonderful human being, my son. And then I moved to Chicago. And stayed in Chicago because I had two sisters that lived there and family's really important to me, and was at DePaul for a while. And it's interesting because one of the things that you had asked about, like advice or, you know, how'd you climb this ladder?
Yeah.
And I had, when I got to DePaul, DePaul was the largest Roman Catholic institution. It was 25,000 students, but they were operating like the school underneath the LTRACs. Like they had 5,000 students. And, you know, when I define my leadership or my career, it's all about creating efficiencies and students have to be at the center. And so I cleaned up a lot of things at DePaul, you know, surrounding graduation and completion. And I had a boss who left DePaul and I loved him. And I was devastated when he left because he was the person that taught me, try it, Angela. If it doesn't work, try it again and figure it out differently. And he left and I was devastated. And a year after he had left DePaul, he had gone to a smaller school out in River Forest, Illinois. And he said, hey, would you be interested in coming and joining me? And he's like, you'd be starting up our professional academic advising. And I was like, of course, because I loved working with Jeff Carlson. He was a theologian. So he cared. He had empathy. And he always cared about critical thinking and asking that second and that third question. And that aligns with who I am. And so I jumped on that in a heartbeat. And it's not like I didn't enjoy what I was doing at DePaul, but Dominican grew me. I grew up at Dominican because when you work at a smaller campus, and for your listeners who work at small campuses, you're not only recruiting students, you're also running your campus ambassador program. You're creating scholarship programs because you don't have the resources. So it allows you to be creative. And yeah. he allowed me to just try all kinds of new stuff. And I just worked my way up to the point where I was an assistant dean. And then from an assistant dean, I became the VP of student services. Well, it was student success and engagement. And that was, we built that up from the ground up. And I said, we, because at small schools, you don't do anything by yourself. You work with faculty, you work with other administrators, you work with those front facing staff who really have their hand or their eye on the pulse of what is happening. And I got into enrollment services, like my experiences was because I sat on the at-risk, first the at-risk admission team, you know, those students that didn't quite meet our admission criteria. And then it was, you remember that year where everybody got all those students and they didn't know where they came from. Like nobody, they had these large classes and nobody could say, where did the students come from? That's because nobody was looking at the kindergartners, you know, 18 years previous and they all grew up and they all came to our college campuses. So we created a, what does it mean to have a large class? And, you know, enrollment just has continued to transcend or transform. But Dominican gave me my foot in the whole enrollment world because they were willing to try new things. They were willing to leverage scholarships and not try to increase their, you know, that tuition discount that kills everybody. You know,
I don't know what you mean.
they were willing to look at alternative ways to recruit students. But then also, too, we knew that we had a growing Hispanic population and we needed to tap into how can we best meet their needs and tap into some resources that could support so that we could meet their needs. And a lot of schools wait until it's too late. And Dominican did not wait until it was too late. And I would say WCTC, we're not waiting until it's too late. We are being proactive and not reactive. And I can appreciate that.
So Angela, this seems like a time where I go back to a question that you and I discussed, I think it was over lunch. At what was that place in Pewaukee?
It's my favorite place in Pewaukee. Yep. So for if any listener is in the Pewaukee area, it's called Artisan 179. They have the best smash burger. It's farm to table. And they hire young people that give the best customer service.
I still have the recipe for that drink that we didn't have. But one of the aforementioned wonderful wait staff had suggested to you, because he like went hustling to find out what the drink was, because you were looking for ideas for the wedding.
Yes. I think.
Anyway, that's all a long preamble for, I think we talked about that someday you were going to be a college president when we were at lunch.
Yeah.
How's that? How are you feeling about that?
Ken, that's a funny question. You know,
is a funny question, but it's a good question.
It's a good question.
When I hear your portfolio right now and the things that you've done and the ways that you're thinking about the work and your previously mentioned interest or at least curiosity about it, I'm curious what you're thinking.
So let me tell you, when I was at Talladega College, I was on the board of trustees for 2 years. And it was an elected, you know, student elected position. And I said, I think I want to be a college president. You know, I mean, if I am honest with you, since third grade, I was going to be the first African-American Supreme Court justice. Now, this was before Thurgood Marshall had been appointed to the Supreme Court. And so I was just like, the first female. So that's what it was.
Okay.
And I just was really thinking about that. And then I got to college and I took a history class and I didn't like it. And I was like, what am I going to do? But that board of trustees really opened me up on like, you can run a college, Angela. Yeah, it's going to require a lot of partnerships and fundraising. And I'm not afraid to ask people for money because what's the worst they can do? Say no. Okay. So then you just ask the next person. And so I've been preparing myself, just growing myself as a leader. And but I'm watching what is happening right now. College presidents have the most challenging job in this environment that we live in. So I do waffle back and forth, Ken. I will not lie to you. My president that I currently work with, who I enjoy working with, this is his first college presidency. And he's younger, and so he's idealistic, and I love that about him. And he's like, Angela, you're ready, you're ready, you're ready. But how do you know you're ready? You know,
You never know.
And I'm watching what's happening, like that pressure for college presidents. Like, you have your state legislators, you have these, you know, new laws that are being enacted. And my biggest fear is, and I shared this with Ken, you know, it took me 46 years, and I'm older than 46, but 46 years to become my authentic self and to live my best life. I've been muzzled all my life. You know, I'm the youngest of five girls. My father was a Pentecostal preacher, so women didn't have a place in the church, so you don't get a voice there. I lived in a very segregated city, and so I didn't have a voice there. And I just, I discovered my voice shortly after one of my sisters died, and I said, I don't want to live that life in a box of people defining who Angela is and how she operates. And college presidents have that pressure because you have you have your board that you're dealing with. You have your community members. And can I authentically be myself is the question that I ask every time. That's now if I can and yes, I'm going to be politically correct. I'm going to navigate the waters. But it is challenging to, you know, for that.
Well,
and you have parents.
Your own students, too.
Yes.
I mean, and a lot of times they have different opinions about when they will tell you what you should be doing. Well, you know, you look at Colorado College's president, who is stepping down at the end of this year for the same reasons, because she's not able to do what you were just saying you would like to be able to do, which is she's not able to bring her whole self to the work. Or at least felt like she couldn't bring her full self to the
world. I read that article and yes.
That must have felt true. But you even look at what happened with, you know, the Ivy presidents who went in front of Congress. And yes, that was a disaster. But at the same time, you could hear the narratives probably playing in their heads as they're answering the questions, because they're thinking of all of these different constituents who are all looking for a different answer out of that question. And how do you thread that needle?
How do you
as a president? Because it's not you, it's the you're speaking for the institution.
You're speaking for the institution. So you lose your voice. And there was an article.
And if you use it, be careful.
Because then they're going to come after you. We also live in this cancel culture, you know, and you do one wrong thing. There is a state president that is retiring or whatever because of something that happened in his personal life. And I'm like, that was his personal life. And it's like,
you're talking about a little northwest of where you are right
exactly.
now. Right?
Yes. And you just don't get to have that personal life anymore. Or you've got to find the balance and and it's just a concern. It's not saying that I won't pursue it because, you know, Rich is my boss. We talk about this. He's like, there's a need for a president like you. You know, at the center for me is student success. And that's because I was a first generation college student. And so I had to learn on my own how to navigate the higher ed lens. You know, that landscape was, you know, we put landmines all over the place for students and I want to remove those landmines. But at the same time, what am I willing to give up?
Oh, man.
Personally give up. There was an article last week and I haven't purchased this book, but Mary Hinton, I think she's a president. It's a school in maybe North Carolina. It was on the joys
Googling of learning quickly.
Yeah. On the joys of learning to lead from the margins. And it just resonated with me because she talks about being this marginalized human, you know, she's from rural North Carolina. She's a Black woman, you know, she's Black. She grew up poor. You know, I didn't grow up in rural area, but I grew up in an inner city, you know, first gen. And she's like, but you got to lead from the margins and, you know, don't try to change yourself. And the thing that really just stuck out to me is like she said that, this is a quote, she says, one of the deep losses in society right now is we are either afraid to show one another our humanity or we're afraid to hold gently to the humanity of another. And that just really resonated with me is because I see our students as humans, they're whole people. I see my staff, you know, from that same lens. And yet we want them to become something that they're not. And I teach a class on living your best life. That's one of the other things that I do. Yes. And I love that class. And I tell students, define who you want to become instead of allowing the world to define that. And that's hard for people because our entire lives have been, it's permission based. Do I have permission to become this person? Do I have permission to become a president? And that's what I ask myself. Do I have permission? You know, am I ready? You know, what's holding me back? And I did recently apply for a college presidency. I have not heard anything, but when I was writing all of my application material and going through items, I said, you are ready, Angela. You're ready to lead the next generation of students, faculty, and staff so that they can become who they desire to be.
Well, Angela, let's just submit this along with your credentials for any presidential applications that you're making. This has been great.
Thank you. I'm
looking at the time. I can't believe how quickly this is
going. I know. It went so fast, Ken.
Actually, I can believe how quickly this has gone. This is like every conversation we've had.
Yes.
I realize you have a very important job that I need to let you get back to, but I cannot let you go without first putting you through the rapid descent.
Let's go.
Mountain metaphor all the way. All right. So you ready? Question number one, Angela, what's your walkout song?
I don't have a walkout song. I don't like music. Oh my gosh.
This interview is over. Goodbye.
It's so funny. I am that person.
You know what? We're going to have to actually, the assignment is going to be, okay, dear listener, you have just heard a whole lot of Angela talking. You get a sense of her energy and what drives her engine or the engine that she is. What would be a fitting song that you would give to Angela?
Yeah. I just,
right. Are you soliciting some, maybe would you be open to some options?
I am open to some options.
All right. Okay. Okay.
I'm a Beyonce
and you don't like
fan.
Music.
I like artists, but I'm not a person that is sitting in the car and the, you know, they've got to stay in the car because their song is playing. That's not me.
You've got other things to do.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, good. And you know what? That's you being you.
Yes.
All right.
Hopefully I can answer the other
lately?
One. The best thing that I have read lately is it's called Transcendent Kingdom, and it's by Yah Gawasi. She is a Ghanaian author, and her first book was called Homegoing, and I read it right before I moved to Ghana. And so this is a follow-up, and it talks about the transition of leaving your home country and moving to a new country and what her family experienced. And it's rich. It is rich. And I teach a book in my class. It's the third encyclical by Pope John Paul II. And he talks about, you don't know how hard it is for an immigrant to pick up and leave everything that they're familiar with and come to a new country. And so, and it just kind of gives you that firsthand account of what it was like for her mother, her father, and her brother moving to America.
Okay. It goes on the list. And I want to pause here. You've mentioned Ghana a couple times now throughout this conversation, and you live in two places.
I do.
Right?
I am transcontinental.
So just,
I have a house in Ghana because my husband and bonus daughter live in Ghana, and my husband and I run a business in Ghana. We run a tour business for those that are interested in traveling to Ghana, but we also run, he does hospitality consulting, but we sell high-end, what I call bathroom, kitchen, all of those things.
Okay.
So,
this was going to be an ad either.
I
but
know.
This is, I didn't know you did this.
Yes.
Angela.
And so I'm in Ghana every 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if let's say the host of a podcast that you happen to know decides he'd like to go and visit Ghana sometime.
Happy.
He should talk to you.
He should talk to me.
Okay. Okay.
He should talk.
Know.
I've been doing it since 2007.
Okay. Awesome. So thanks for the detour.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure that we, I want to make sure that folks understood that you live transcontinentally and you have a pretty big job.
I do.
Okay. Thing number three, What thing number three? Question number three. What's something you're eager to read next? And is it the book you just described?
I am eager to read. It is called The Love Song of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Jeffers. Her mother was my English professor when I was an undergrad. And really? I purchased the book as soon as it came out, but it's got to be like 300 or 400 pages. And I just have not had the time to read it. So
you could knock that out on one of those transcontinental flights.
I sleep. I'm just going to be honest. I sleep.
Number four, if you have any podcasts that you're a fan of, what's one that you particularly enjoy?
And this is a great one for higher ed people. It is Mongoose. They used to do it live. Now they send it out. Mongoose is a texting platform, or Cadence is maybe their parent company. But they literally have the best podcast on enrollment, on student support. As soon as I get that email, I go directly to their YouTube and I listen to that podcast because it's wonderful. I used to love the live versions because you used to be able to ask questions as an audience. So you felt like you were on a radio show. That's one of my favorite podcasts.
Okay. Great tip. Thank you. All right. What's your favorite thing to make in the kitchen?
I don't have a favorite thing, but I can tell you the things that I make well. I make banana pudding. It's not your mama's banana pudding. You want to slap somebody. It's that good. It's that good. It is that good. Okay. Yep. So, I will not give the recipe out unless I move from that city, because we can't both show up with my banana pudding. So...
It's that good.
It's that good. Yeah.
It's like its own currency.
It is.
What do you use to take and keep your notes?
So when I was in my doctoral program, I became a millennial. And I started using my cell phone for everything. So I use the notes.
I felt like you went back in time.
No, maybe. I use the notes on my, I have an iPhone. And so they have a notes, you can have folders and everything. Mm-hmm. That's what I use to take notes.
Okay. What is a memorable bit of advice you've received?
I'm going to give you two, if that's okay. My mother used to say to us, if you don't think you look good, no one will think you look good. And if no one thinks that I look good, you better think that I look good. So my mother, we are very confident women. I can honestly tell you that. And I'm a plus size woman. So people are often surprised at how confident I am as a fuller figure woman. And it was because my mother taught us to have that level of confidence. And then my second piece of advice that someone has given me is try it if it works. And this is Jeff Carlson, my former boss. Right. And I share that with many people. And it's okay to fail. Because when you fail, you learn from it. And I stress that to my team more than anything.
And you make it safe for them to take the risks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not everybody.
I love that you added that, because a lot of people do not make it safe to take risks.
Right. All right. Last one. Name an item on your bucket list, presuming you have a bucket list, that you haven't yet checked off.
I don't have a bucket list, but I have a travel. Okay. I have a travel list.
All right.
And I would love to go to Australia. I used to, when I was in graduate school, I don't know how somebody accidentally sent me a subscription of Condé Nast, which was a travel magazine.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And this was in the '90s, the late '90s, and I've been wanting to go to Australia since then. Now I've traveled all around the world, and I'm actually going to Bali coming up. You know, and
I'm sorry.
I know.
Really?
I know. I had a wedding. Last year I had a wedding, so I couldn't, I would have gone to see Beyonce in concert abroad, but I had a wedding that cost a whole lot of money. So,
All right.
Australia is on my travel list that I have not done.
So, do you go to
yet.
Australia from Ghana, or do you go there from the States?
Hey, I don't know. I would have to figure that out, because it has to be a place that my husband can travel along with me, you know?
Okay.
But that's on the list.
Angela, this has been a blast. This is fun catching up with you.
I always love talking to you. I love that you do this podcast. And I would just leave this piece of advice to people, is just be your authentic self. Because as we're working with students, students want to know your story because your story will inspire them.
Thank you for that.
So
wise words. All right.
All right.
I have to finish the show with the way I always finish it, but I will say, Angela, thank you for all the wisdom nuggets that you dropped. And someday I have to have that banana pudding.
When you come back this way, or maybe when I come out to visit you, then that's what we'll I'll bring you some.
Colorado's an easy hop.
It is.
Well, I will close as I always do, which is say, Angela, thanks for being on. May all your big dreams come true, at least the good ones. And to you, dear listener, thanks for listening. Be well and do well.